Well, somebody came up to me today in St. Louis and said, hey, who's on the show tonight? What are you going to talk about? And I said, well, we've got investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe on. She comes up every month with these special reports, special stories that she covers all around this planet. And he went, oh, she's one of the hardest working people I've ever known. So he's glued to his radio tonight, and so many others are. In a moment, Linda Moulton Howe joins us with four separate stories, investigative stories that will wow you, inform you, and tantalize you. And then the last hour of the program tonight, conversations with Linda. Questions, and perhaps you can give her some stories that she runs with and then investigates and comes back and reports on those on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Noyd, noted author, researcher, Emmy Award-winning writer, television producer, investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe with us tonight for her special monthly series of reports of incredible stories. And here's Linda. Linda, how are you?
I am good, and I am glad that spring is coming, but this is the longest winter holding on to the U.S., I think. My gosh, even here in Albuquerque, it normally should be a lot warmer, and we go snow, sun, snow, sun. So anyway, I'm glad we have passed the mark of the, we're getting closer anyway to a warmer season. And I am going to start tonight with an email that I received after last month's Coast.
Okay.
This is one of those valuable pieces of gold that came from a man who was listening. And this is what he said. It was very short and very simple. I have also had a UFO occurrence at a large Air Force base in Central California while I was on active duty there. If you are interested, let me know. Thanks, Steve, in Southern California. Well, I got a hold of him and learned that Steve was born and raised in San Diego, where he graduated from high school in 1966 and went right into the U.S. Air Force. And after basic training in security police duties, he was first assigned to Kunsan, Korea, for about 18 months. And then that was followed by a tour of duty at Vandenberg Air Force Base near Santa Maria, California, which is northwest of Santa Barbara. And he was there from 1967 to 1970. Steve told me that since he and several other U.S. Air Force security men watched an otherworldly aerial machine emit a greenish-blue beam onto a C-5 at Vandenberg, he has never talked to anyone about the experience. Steve said the day after the encounter, he was ordered by a United States Air Force Office of Special Investigations colonel, quote, "You did not see anything," close quote. Jeez. But now, at age 60, he says all humans deserve the truth, and agreed to talk with me in a recorded phone interview with only the name Steve, which is not his full real name. And this is the reason he gave, quote, "Because I think overall the people have a right to know more than what the government is just keeping to themselves," close quote. Here now is former U.S. Air Force security airman Steve.
Here we go.
For some reason, they assign the priority of this jet coming in, they considered it a hot cargo. When you get a call that you got a hot cargo coming in, that's something pretty important that they need security for. We saw the plane land. It came up to where it was assigned to be parked on the tarmac. We went over there after the plane secured, and we met up with the onboard security police personnel. They had four or five security police officers with the plane guarding whatever the cargo was. So they invited us to come into the plane because this was a brand new C-5 Galaxy, just came out and was just flying in the Air Force, and it was a gigantic military plane. And I noticed that the only cargo that was in the plane was two wooden crates that weren't real big. They might have been about 3 feet high and about 10 feet long. They were stacked on top of each other. There was nothing else in the whole plane. Just these two crates. We went back outside, and we were outside for about maybe a minute or two. Then all of a sudden, we noticed dropping down from the sky was this craft that had absolutely no sound to it. It came straight down, and I would guess that it was about 500 yards away from us at about 300 feet, and it just sat there.
What was the shape and color?
Well, the shape of it was hard to determine. The only thing you could definitely make out was two orangey-red glowing sort of like lights that were on opposite sides of each other. Maybe they could have been a few hundred feet apart. And then it went up into almost like a wishbone shape. It looked to be some type of silvery alloy material it was made out of. It was a cloudless night. It was very dark. There was really no moon out or anything.
Was the very first thing that you saw coming down from the sky the red-orange lights separated from each other?
Yeah, but they seemed to be attached to a frame that went vertically up into the sky.
It came down about how close?
Maybe 300-400 feet off the runway, about that height. And it must have been at least 500 to 600-700 yards away.
Were you seeing enough in reflected light to get a sense of the size?
You know, right now in my mind, I can see it clearly. It was probably 800-900 feet in length, vertically going up, and going across, it might have been 300-400 feet. It was pretty good size. From those two glowing red lights, the distance between them, viewing it from the ground, it looked to be 300 to 400, maybe 500 feet between the two orbs of light. It was pretty much over the runway as far as being perpendicular to it. And the main runway from the tarmac and the parking area where the jet was probably about 1,000 feet from where we were standing right next to the galaxy.
Okay. How many of you are watching this?
Well, there was the three of us plus the four, I think there was four, it could have been five, other security police personnel that were assigned to fly with the plane. Okay, so about nine of us.
And are you all watching this and you don't hear a sound?
No, it's absolutely silent. It surprised us when it came into our sight. It just came straight down without any sound. The only reason we knew it was there because we could see it dropping down, and then it stabilized at about 500 feet above the ground.
And what were you all saying or yelling to each other?
Nothing. We were all just totally in awe. I don't remember saying anything while we were watching it to anybody. I don't remember hearing anybody talking to anybody else. We were all just stunned by it. You see something that totally is so uncharacteristic of anything you normally see, just to appear right in front of you is pretty astounding.
What did happen?
Okay, from that point, it was in its hover position. It turned on a beam of light that shined onto the plane itself. It didn't shine on us. It shined on top of the plane.
The new C-5.
Yes, it did. Directed its beam like a laser beam onto the C-5 itself, like it was aiming it right towards the cargo bay area.
And Steve, what color was that beam and about how wide was it?
Color, I remember as greenish blue. And the width of it, it wasn't much wider than the plane itself. So the plane was probably about 25 feet wide. You know, the cargo bay itself, not the wings and so forth, but just the cargo, the fuselage of the plane. That's what I'm talking about. That's what it directed its beam on, towards the middle of the C-5.
And that's where those two containers were that you...
Yeah, roughly in that area.
What happened?
It shined the light on for about 10 seconds, and then the light went out completely. And then after that, within a few seconds, the UFO just went very quickly right back up into the sky vertically and just disappeared.
And do you guys run over to the C-5 and run in to see what's happened to those two pieces of cargo?
No, we didn't, but the security police that were assigned to the plane did. They went back inside. Then they came out and said that they would be leaving shortly, and it was time for us to leave as well.
Did you hear whether or not they tried to look inside the containers, what might have happened inside of that C-5?
Before the UFO showed up, we were talking, and I asked the one sergeant who was in charge of the detail, I asked him, well, where are you guys going from here? He says, we're going to Groom's Lake. Now, that's what Area 51 is called now.
Right.
But back then it was called Groom's Lake. He said, they're going to Groom's Lake. Well, I had no idea where that is. I said, well, where's that? He said, it's somewhere in Nevada. So I do remember him saying that. Whatever this hot cargo was, the next stop was over there to Groom's Lake.
Did anybody ever talk to you, even in rumor, about what was in those containers that the UFO seemed to be so interested in that it put a beam of light down where you all knew that there were just two containers in there?
No, nobody ever told me anything about the contents. We didn't have a need to know, for one thing. We were there only to provide a little additional security while the plane was on the ground. But when all this was over, we went back to headquarters because it was another 40 minutes or so before we were to get off duty and another crew was to come on and take over. We reported the incident to our flight sergeant, who was a master sergeant. He took notes. That was it for the night, so we left and we got off duty. Well, the next day, I was on duty again from 4 to 12, but I was on a different assignment. And after I was on duty for about 2 hours, a Air Force staff car came up to where I was working the gate. And this person got out dressed in a civilian suit and came over and showed me his identification. He was a colonel from the OSI, which is Office of Special Investigation. And he's in plain clothes. He said, are you such and such? I said, yes, I am. I said, do you want to know about the UFO incident? He just said, you didn't see anything. You didn't see anything, did you? I said, no, sir, I didn't. He turned around and he left. And that's the last I ever had any incident with this UFO sighting.
Did you talk with any of your buddies or anybody else off the record about that conversation and about what in the world was this huge thing that came to the C-5?
The other two guys that were with me, I never saw them again. I don't ever remember talking to them about what we saw. And the fact that the OSI officer, he didn't even want to hear my account, tells me he already knew what transpired. They already know what happened. So he didn't want to hear anything I had to say. He just wanted to make sure I didn't repeat it to anybody.
And this separation of people who have had encounters in a military context with something that would fall into the category of UFOs?
Yeah.
It is almost like standard operating procedure. Separate those eyewitnesses around the world. Send them to separate bases so they won't compare notes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought they must have been reassigned somewhere else rather quickly. Or maybe they didn't want to cooperate with the OSI. But being a very young person at the time, and this was a colonel from the OSI giving you a direct order, I wasn't about to tell him, no, I want to talk about it. I went along with the program at the time.
If you had said to the colonel from the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, sir, why are you telling me that I didn't see what I saw? What do you think would have happened?
Oh, I would have probably been disciplined, if not given a discharge. They made it very clear that if you don't cooperate, you're going to be dealt with severely. That was my impression. You know, it isn't too often that you get a colonel to come to see you from OSI. I mean, they have captains and majors as well, but this was the colonel himself. And that's the first time I ever dealt with anybody from OSI. I knew they were on the base, but I didn't have any direct contacts with them.
So it was to intimidate you to keep your mouth shut?
Yeah, basically, that's what it came to. You didn't see anything, and if you try to talk, well, it's not going to be too good for you.
What residue are you left with in the OSI colonel's order that you didn't see what you saw?
Well, I have to believe that it was an alien craft of another world. I think it wanted to track or keep an eye on the contents of what was in that plane, keeping an eye on its
hot cargo.
It's hot cargo, yeah, basically. Like I said, I got to believe that the craft that we saw was being controlled by intelligent beings, not of this world, because we have nothing and still don't have anything that could perform the way this craft did, especially being totally silent, making no noise whatsoever.
And George, Steve made a really clear illustration using a photo of an actual C-5 with the drawing of what it was that he remembered seeing. And if you go to earthfiles.com, and at the top of the headlines page are the four reports that I'm doing tonight, and the top one is about the C-5. When you click to the report and scroll down, there is a large image of his original that he sent me, and I think it's important for you and the audience to take a look at this because the description, it shows you that it is so valuable to try to have people do illustrations. I asked him if he would, because when people are trying to describe something that they are looking at, they're inside of their mind, and it usually doesn't communicate. As he was originally telling me that this was something that was 800 feet in the air, sort of like stories. Well, when you look at his illustration, it's one of these V-shaped objects that have been reported for decades but are highly mysterious, and to be so large, about 500 feet in diameter, estimated 800 feet high, and putting the beam down, this would be an overwhelming sight to those nine young airmen that were there at Vandenberg. And this whole beam technology, I have run into it from the first investigations that I did in the animal mutilations. I have heard sheriffs, I have heard deputies, I have heard ranchers, and I've heard even other reporters talk about seeing lights in the sky and suddenly a beam of light that comes down that is either like a milky white and translucent and seems to be interacting with something in the soil and the plants, or this greenish blue has been described in many various different kinds of encounters, making me think, well, maybe the colors in these beams have something to do with how much energy has to be applied to bring something up or take it down. And in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, there is an amazing case that I think I'm going to flesh out at earthfiles.com, because so far it is only in my book. But it took place also at a military base, Fort Stewart, near Hinesville, Georgia, and this was back in 1974. And this was a man, he had served in Vietnam, a well-responsible guy, and he had gone to a base movie theater that was outdoors with his wife. And suddenly, they both see this light. The light puts down a very bizarre beam that has blue and white in it. And then you get to this description. There was something floating upward in the beam of light. My first impression was that it was a person, because I could clearly see four long appendages like arms and legs, and one short appendage like a head. And they are watching the husband and wife, this beam. They're in the back of an outdoor movie theater, and they're watching this occur. And they don't really even understand why other people in other cars aren't getting out. And he tries to report it. He goes to superior officers, says, this is what happened, and describes it. And just exactly like Steve, he's told that it would be wise if he decided that he had not seen what he had seen and to forget about it. Well, what is this beam technology that seems to be able, around the world, to pluck up soil, grass, water, animals, plants, and even humans?
That was compelling, Linda, and it's, again, another reason why these conversation with Linda moments are so important when you get phone calls like that. Up next, Linda talks about cyber theft on Coast to Coast AM. Streamlink, are you a member? Well, if you're not, for just pennies a day, you can sign up and get downloads, podcasting, and even now iPhone apps and past archives as well. It's 3 years past and soon to be expanded even more. When we come back, Linda Moultonhow joins us with part two, another story, this one on cyber theft on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, cyber wars, cyber theft is going to be huge these days. You know, just watching your story that you've been working on here made me think of the days of Gary McKinnon out there, who was fighting extradition right. from Britain to the United States for tapping into NASA files and other secret files, claiming that all he wanted to do was find out about UFOs, even though he admits he broke in.
Right, but now it is really becoming a much more serious problem with other nations, and at the top of that list is China, and mm-hmm. it's a very sensitive subject. And all of this came into focus for me the first week of March. I was in Houston to attend the NASA Lunar and Planetary Institute conference, and to my surprise, one subject that kept coming up in conversations and in the Houston media is persistent attacks by cyber spies, especially from China. On March 4th, KHOU.com ran a story about cyber spies infiltrating Houston oil companies and NASA. KHOU stated, quote, "The Chinese operate a large consulate in Houston, but a liaison there did not respond to our request for a response to our report. Whoever is behind the Houston cyber spy attacks show that spies no longer have to even get up from their keyboards to infiltrate Houston's leading industries," close quote. To better understand the cyber spy threat, I contacted William Conklin, PhD, an assistant professor in the College of Technology at the University of Houston. I asked him if he had firsthand knowledge about cyber spy infiltrations of Houston NASA and oil company computers, and I told him about a remarkable conversation I had with one of the scientists at the conference. Here now is Professor Conklin.
I do know that oil firms in the United States, specifically in the Houston area where a lot of oil firms are headquartered, have been targeted by parties yet unidentified, although China comes to the top of the list for blame. But the exact parties have never been completely identified. Information is worth money.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to bid on the next major oil contract? Your competitors would love to know.
Well, recently I was at the NASA Lunar and Planetary Institute conference, the first week of March in Houston. One of the planetary scientists there came up to me and said, "You need to know about something that has happened recently. One of my colleagues was working at his computer on life support systems if we had a manned mission to, say, Mars or to the moon. He got a phone call first by a NASA manager and then by someone who identified themselves as with the National Security Agency. Both callers asked the scientist to shut down his computer and pull the cord from the wall. When the scientist asked why, he was told that China was downloading information from his computer at NASA.
I have no doubt NASA would be under attack, especially here in the Houston area. Manned spaceflight is an area of competition between nations. We have significant intellectual property in that area. And China would not be the only country, in my mind, that would be going after that. Just list all the countries that are going into space, and they would benefit from taking NASA's information. If my manager called, I know who he is, or somebody in my own management chain, I'd ignore them at my peril. Somebody from Department of Defense, DOD, Homeland Security, NSA, any of those agencies, I would not expect them to call, and if they did, I'd refer them to, hey, talk to my management.
Well, the implication in this case was that the National Security Agency was monitoring certain Chinese agencies and watching what they were doing and knew at that moment in real time that someone from China was downloading information from a NASA computer.
Various government agencies, the NSA probably, the U.S. CERT as part of Homeland Security, definitely have the ability to monitor communications to and from government computers inside the .gov domain, i.e. NASA. And so there's no doubt that if there was an intrusion and anyone else was listening or downloading information, that I would expect the U.S. CERT more than NSA would be alerted to that and take action on part of the federal government. They would also have the ability to interrupt the transfer. So that makes sense. That's part of the reason we have the U.S. CERT as part of Homeland Security to protect our government computers. In that aspect, they are being monitored, they are being watched, and when they see activity like that, they have the ability to do things, to block those transfers.
CERT stands for
Computer Emergency Response Team. It's an agency underneath Homeland Security Department to monitor government computers for security.
Are they based in the National Security Agency?
No, they are separate. National Security Agency's responsibility is for Department of Defense. The U.S. CERT under Homeland Security is responsible for all the rest of government computers.
But I assume that CERT and NSA work tightly together.
Yes, they do. All the major government organizations communicate clearly. And that's why, in this case with NASA, NASA is a government agency, and I would expect that if the NSA found something, they would contact NASA system administrators and tell NASA, you need to fix this, not us. The current state of computer security is one of the most pressing demands. It's been noticed by the federal government at all levels. It's been noticed as a bipartisan issue. Congress, they just recently passed a bill like 424-5 concerning information on this. That makes it pretty nonpartisan and shows the importance. Our competitive advantage that we have gained through our intellectual property over the years is being taken away for free or at much cheaper cost to others via computer downloads. An oil company can have billions of dollars at stake in a pending deal for some new oil development, and they can lose the bid to a foreign oil company because a foreign company uses their intelligence agencies to gather the information to overbid them by just that narrow amount.
And the fact that NASA computers can be accessed and downloaded by nations such as China, does it imply that computers by Chinese labor were engineered during the Chinese assembly of computers so they would have easy access?
Is there a risk from foreign manufacturer? Yes, but there's an equal risk from U.S. manufacturer because we have an open society where students come here from all over the world, learn things, form their own little companies. American talent has been developed by people coming from all over the globe to America. Our free society, our ability to create, do new things with capitalism. Spies are born and raised in our own country as well. So the fact that things happen offshore is not the main concern. The main concern is how do you keep those bad things from being built into machines? And there are a lot of efforts underway as part of the government and corporate entities to make certain those things don't happen. There's an equal issue on counterfeit parts to where it's not that I want to make a part to steal your information, but say a company like Cisco spends a lot of money developing and building routers that run the internet, and then some company wants to make fake ones because they don't want to spend the money to develop them. They just want to make knockoffs. Just like you can buy designer handbags for $10 and Rolexes for $10, this high-tech equipment, the same issues are happening.
Well, how do we protect NASA, other corporations, from invasion by China and other cyber spies?
We have to protect our electronic assets the same way we protect our physical assets. Banks a long time ago did not have real strong vaults. And we all remember the movie Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, where it's pretty easy for them to waltz in and take money. Today, you can't do that because it became important enough that banks built the protection mechanisms. We have to learn how to and spend the money and the time and effort to protect our intellectual property the same way. One of the challenges is if I take something that you own tangibly, like your car, you don't get to use it anymore. And so it's in your interest to protect it so that you don't lose use of it. The problem with information people don't realize is that I can take a copy of your information. You still get to use it, but so do I. And so the actual efforts to protect many of these computer information systems aren't deemed as important from a risk perspective because the company doesn't lose it. They just let someone else also have it. That mentality is changing. Government is making considerable efforts to secure literally hundreds of thousands of computer systems throughout our government, not just the high profile like NASA and defense, but even things like the IRS, because all of them contain information worth copying. And the copy is just as valuable to the thief. He doesn't have to actually take away your copy. He just needs his copy.
And meanwhile, the United States, NASA agencies and corporations are vulnerable to this kind of espionage. And it was only a couple of years ago in 2008, the Business Week did an article that said NASA was particularly vulnerable because so many of its outside contractors access its computers over the web, close quote.
That is true, although I would be able to argue the same thing for online banking, that all of us access our bank's computer systems over the web. The web has become the way everybody accesses everything. And so what makes NASA an interesting target is the value of the information it has, which, if anything, should tell the American taxpayer that we've had a good investment in NASA. If they've created intellectual property the other people want to steal. But they are not ignoring computer security. They're working it like all other agencies and doing their best to shore up the defenses with the current available technology. China is undoubtedly spying. If they're not spying, then what are they doing? Not an open adversary, but a potential future adversary. Right now, we're economic allies. We have a lot to benefit each other. But there are other allies that also spy on each other. Israel spies on its neighbors. France spies on its neighbors. Great Britain spies on its neighbors. It's been happening for thousands of years. The fact we can do it now by the computer makes it somewhat more interesting, but doesn't change the equation that if you have important information, you need to protect it, not leave it out where someone else will take it. I just came back this weekend from a collegiate cyber defense competition in which college students were defending networks against attackers. Once they got the defenses properly configured and were spending the right amount of effort on defending their networks, it made it virtually impossible for the adversary to take any significant amount of information. Computer networks can be defended.
What is the worst case that could happen from your point of view?
Smart grid, I see, as a huge future for the United States in fixing our electric system, modernizing it, making it much more efficient. Smart grids connecting a lot of our electrical systems to the internet. And we will fall prey to these same problems over again if we do not upfront make the proper investments and efforts in security. And I see that as a bigger imminent threat than the intellectual property loss.
That the more we go to smart grids in everything from energy to communications, we then become vulnerable to a terrorist attack that could bring down all of our power or all of our communications.
Yep, or our banking. The more people put their personal information out online, the more people are willing to let their own personal computers, by not maintaining them, become part of botnets, the bigger this whole problem becomes. It's one of overall awareness and saying, hey, with the internet comes responsibility to each and every person that wants to put a machine on it.
And George, it was very interesting to me that in the research on this story that I found that in February, just a month ago, that Homeland Security did a kind of review of threats and hazards and long-term global challenges and trends that this country is facing. And in the executive summary, there was a graphic that had that title of threats, hazards, and long-term global challenges and trends. And here under threats and hazards are the three top. High-consequence weapons of mass destruction, that would be like nuclear weapons, al-Qaeda and global violent extremism, and third, high-consequence and or wide-scale cyber attacks, intrusions, disruptions, and exploitations. That is means that our country looks at that as one of the top three problems that we're facing going into the future. And it was only about 5 months ago that the Grumman Corporation worked on a paper that was looking at these same issues. In fact, the title was called Capability of the People's Republic of China to Conduct Cyber Warfare and Computer Network Exploitation. And this was prepared for the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. And I've got the top part of this with a link at my website on this report about cyber spies. And one of the quotes really pops out. It says, a long-term persistent campaign to collect sensitive but unclassified information from U.S. government and U.S. defense industry networks using computer network exploitation techniques long attributed to China has successfully exfiltrated, that is a word that means using nefarious ways that you gather something, successfully exfiltrated at least 10 to 20 terabytes of data from U.S. government networks as of 2007, according to U.S. Air Force estimates. And that figure has possibly grown in the past 2 years, though no figure is publicly available, close quote, in October, just a few months ago. Well, now, with this news coming out of Houston, from both the NASA side and then from the KHOU doing the report about many cyber attacks that they knew about inside of the Houston oil companies and NASA, it shows you that this is ongoing around us all the time now. And the consequences as we go into the future, as he was describing, as Professor Conklin was describing, we're going to be moving toward smart grids for our energy systems that could include nuclear, as well as our power grids, as well as our hydroelectric, and whatever else is online. And eventually, I would imagine that there is a grand plan to have a smart grid that would be able to organize and make efficient use of all of our energy systems in the United States, from wind power and solar to fossil and nuclear. Well, what if you didn't have the ability to make sure that you had a guarantee that a cyber spy could not get into and affect that power, that smart power grid?
Right.
So suddenly, where we've had small outages, you begin to see that a world that is becoming so interlinked and interdependent with computers and computer networks and now moving toward gigantic smart grids has a real cyber war on its hands to protect those grids.
You know, if we were going to attack a nation again, and of course when we went into Iraq, it was command and control we went after first, it would be a cyber attack, Linda. Shut them down first, and then you come in with your weapons.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. And to realize that we're we're getting into a botnet kind of world, I want to bring your attention and the Coast audience to a wonderful graphic that I found. And Professor Conklin did a below explanation for it. It was his term, evil forces use Trojan horses. And he explains the botnet world and how this works and how it is even possible to get past some of the defenses, and that every person now, every individual has to be aware that they've got to protect their computer from spam, from all of these infiltrations that can come even in email.
Well, Linda, I got to tell you another remarkable story, and this one is coming home to roost. This could happen at any time during this day and age, couldn't it?
Well, and Congress is so concerned about it that there was sort of that mock, CNN did that mock coverage or a coverage of like a mock with people who were on the federal side in the legal system, as well as others who were very kind of experts in this whole cyber area. And they presented a question that was covered on CNN. What would happen? What would be the process of alerting the nation if there was a huge cyber attack?
Well, they better put their act together now. Up next, Linda studies bats. Why? We'll tell you in a moment.